Again to BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 182. I have a very special podcast today. I have an interview with Bill Buepert, but before we get into that, I want to do a little shout-out here for the folks in Washington, D.C. On the 18th of this month, Saturday, at noon, the Raw Milk Freedom Fighters and Lemonade Freedom Day are going to be in Washington, D.C., near the Reflecting Pool, 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson. And if you can get down there and support the cause, support voluntary exchange, if you can bring like a basket of food or a bucket of chicken or whatever, anything you can bring down to voluntary exchange, then you'll support the cause. And be sure and bring a camera or bring an extra person with a camera. That's even better. Okay, so that's the 18th on Saturday. Okay, now I wanted to also mention that I didn't do a podcast yesterday, and I apologize for that. Longtime listeners know that I have a lot of brain damage, and sometimes I have days that I just can't do anything, and sometimes I have days that I can do lots of stuff. So I didn't get a podcast out yesterday. That means a lot because I really try to get one out on Monday every week, and I do apologize to my listeners for that. Now, with no further ado, I'm going to introduce my guest, which is Bill Buepert. He is an amazing individual. I'm not going to read the little profile that everybody always reads. I'm just going to jump right in and start talking. Bill, thank you very much for coming on the show with me.
Hey, good morning, Ben, and I'm honored to be invited onto your podcast.
In addition to being a retired Army officer, what else would you like to tell the folks about yourself?
Well, I'm a farmer. I've been a rancher. I've been, we have a lot of animal husbandry here. My wife is in charge of that. We've homeschooled our children. We are rural folk. We prefer to live in the country. And I have a variety of hobbies, shooting, preparedness, history, those kind of things. So I think that's enough.
Am I right in recalling that you were a sheriff deputy for a while?
As a matter of fact, your memory is extraordinary. I was a reserve search and rescue deputy with the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department in the 1980s while I was in the service and going to school at the Humboldt State University, where if you find Berkeley too right-wing and oppressive, you go to the V.I. Lenin Institute, better known as Humboldt State University in Northern California. And I have to say that I'm sort of ashamed of that, because in my mind, and those who have listened to other interviews with me and other podcasts that I've been on, they will hear this meme come out of my mouth, and I sound like a broken record, but it's very simple. If it weren't for cops, everyone would be free, because whether it's Barack Obama, George W. Bush, you pick your political or philosophical bad actor, if they don't have cops, they cannot rob you of anything.
Yeah, I have made the argument in the past that America began down the path to a police state the day that America, the day that the people of America accepted the concept that there could be some people among us that could enforce law upon the rest of us.
I think that's a keen observation, Ben.
You have a quote that just fascinated me. I literally just broke out laughing because it felt so good to read someone say this. And that is, if it weren't for NASA, we'd be on the moon already. I love that phrase because it's so counterintuitive to what so many people believe. But I believe it's the absolute truth, if there's any reason to be on the moon, that is.
Well, you know, I'm rather comprehensive, very paper thin, but comprehensive in my interest about what happens to me around the world or what the world is doing and how to make sense of it and such. And from my youth, I was a space geek. I even had this ambition to be an astronaut when I was very, very young. That was quickly dispelled, though, once I, especially having gone into the military and seen what that was about, and that, in essence, astronauts are nothing more than highly paid bus drivers. And in this case, I think NASA, over the span of time that it has been in place, has been a great example of how a state agency or a government agency, whether this is through purposeful cognition or by accident or incompetence, to achieve their goals, they always cost a whole lot more than private business would cost. And they always seem to go in fits and starts, and it's filled with mistakes and errors and accidents that cost people lives and tens of billions of dollars. I just think that the perverse incentives that are inherent in government are such that when we take on these large enterprises, inevitably they're done in a fashion that the private business world would have done much more efficiently and much more effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to go off on one of my tangents, but I have contracted to NASA on a couple of occasions. And I was in the aerospace and defense industry for years. And during that time, I contracted to NASA on occasion. And what I found was my coworkers on those projects were some of the smartest people I have ever encountered in my life. But they were all contracting to NASA. The actual NASA employees were basically bubble-headed bureaucrats. And that's not to say that everyone who works for NASA is a bubble-headed bureaucrat. But literally, to a man, every NASA employee that I interacted with on a one-to-one basis was pretty clueless and was more interested in career development than any of the projects we were working on.
I think that's right. I used to live in northern Idaho, and I had a number of very smart friends up there, one of whom was a PhD chemist, and he and I would speculate on why this was the case with both the scientific illiteracy that is so rampant in the United States, despite us being this supposed technological and scientific world leader in innovation and research. And I said, if you look at Apollo 13, which was apocryphal and had a whole lot of artistic license lent to it, it was pretty amazing when you watch the problem-solving abilities of Ron Howard's production of how they essentially solved a problem to bring these guys back. And I said, so Al, what do you think? These are smart guys, and they're smart guys who are government employees, and they're doing great things. He said, well, I think what we have to remember is that's the first generation, essentially, of either government employees or, as you're saying, Ben, contracted employees. Once the succeeding generations came on board, then they become time servers, then they become bureaucrats. And one of the perverse incentives in all bureaucracies, whether it's the Department of Agriculture, Department of Energy, or even NASA, is that if they achieve their end state and goal, what purpose do they serve after that? I mean, I'm amazed, for instance, I saw this this picture of, I think it's the Buryan, which is the Russian-Soviet space shuttle, used to be Soviet, now Russian space shuttle, and it's in a junkyard. And there's old used beds and trash and stuff around it, and I thought, wow, what an ending for that. But then when you look at our space shuttle as a device, the technology in it stopped evolving after 1982. I mean, I've heard rumors, and maybe this is apocryphal, Ben, that NASA had to go on eBay to get 8086 chips for the avionics suites in this because they had never upgraded them or couldn't upgrade them. Much like the B-1B bomber that we have that succeeded the 52 strategic bombing platform that's airborne, the thing is good as a tarmac ornament to move from one end of the runway to the other. But as far as its ability to go aloft and actually, you know, do a mission set, apparently they have so many conflicting avionics suites, computer suites, subcontracts and such, they simply can't talk to each other. So it's a bad aircraft to fly. Much like we see what's happening with the Raptor, both the F-22 and the F-35 programs right now, where they've had oxygen problems with the pilots, or you have these aircraft that amortized over time are literally $1 billion apiece. And then I think to myself, from a warfare perspective, if you're fighting somebody, they will always find a cheaper way to take your expensive crap down.
Absolutely. Yeah, now, am I wrong? Do I recall that you taught in one of the military schools, like VMI or one of those as well?
I did not, but what I taught was I taught at the University of Mississippi as what we call a professor of military history and military science. So I would teach a third and fourth year officer students before they graduated, got their commissions, and went on. It's one of the 3 R's in your Army career, which you do either reserves, recruiting, or ROTC. So I was an ROTC instructor, and I got to teach military history, which is one of my avocations and things that I really enjoy, and military science and critical thinking and intelligence analysis and that kind of thing.
I asked that because I did want to ask you about critical thinking. I want to make a quick comment to finish up our last talk about NASA and so forth and what you were talking about with the planes. Having been in that industry for years, what we saw was that, you know, the private sector being contracted by the government, there were people who put a tremendous amount of effort and really some smart people. But then you would get layers of, again, bureaucrats, each one with a private little thing that they wanted to add to the plane to make it do some magical thing that was their, you know, their pet thing. And it got crazy. But I did want to ask you about critical thinking. And I wanted you to explain when you say critical thinking, what does that mean exactly?
When I tell you this, Ben, it's either going to sound intuitive or it's going to sound silly, but critical thinking is thinking about thinking to improve your thinking through better thinking. I know that sounds a bit trite, but when you tease that out and parse it out, it really makes sense. And the primary reason why critical thinking doesn't take place in our society is because it's heavy lifting and it's work. It's much like with gun training. We have various conditions that Colonel Cooper gave us, from condition white, which is zombified somnambulance, which most everybody is in our society, to condition red and black, which is the actual fight condition where we're in a fight for our lives, our motor skills start to decrease as far as our fine motor skills, we start to get tunnel vision, time starts to slow down, but we are very aware of what's happening. And I teach in the Appleseed Project, and we teach something called the Rifleman's Bubble. And the Rifleman's Bubble is essentially a Zen state in which the purpose and fitness and perfection of what you're doing in that moment to achieve one thing, in this case, to save your life, you're hoping that everything clicks in instinctively, much like a battle drill, where you're not thinking through it, but you're actually doing it because you've practiced it. You know, you can never exceed your highest level of training. And essentially, that's what it comes down to.
Right. And for me, personally, I think I was able to exercise critical thinking the best, or I do exercise it the best. Anyway, I got distracted there, and I'll have to do some magic editing. But in critical thinking, I was able to, for me, I was able to get into my garden and allow myself to do sort of brainless tasks, weeding and things like that, but at the same time, pick a thought and just start taking it apart, like consider something morally, like, you know, like voting or like, you know, any type of activity with government or whatever. And I would begin taking it apart and thinking about each aspect of it and working it down to its root. And what is it exactly that this is, and is it moral? And that that's kind of what I think of when I think of critical thinking, is just examining the processes that are involved in how we analyze something and come up with what we believe about it. Am I way off?
No, not at all. I think that's critical thinking, of course, has is an onion in which there are layers and layers and layers upon it, and so much left and right, up and down are dependent on different ways of examining things. What you were just talking about is what we would call Socratic drilling, which is where you would have a proposition. And you can come up with one, Ben, but let's suppose we said that voting isn't a moral act, and we would try to discover why that is. We would ask ourselves why that is. We would also do counterfactuals and examine why not. What you discover is that your philosophical foundation is fairly sound if you can answer substantively 3 or more times the question why. So if Ben asks me, Bill, why is voting immoral? I would say because essentially, and this would be one aspect of it, essentially you're legitimizing a serial killer beauty contest in which you have these Republicans and Democrats, Libertarians, Green Party, you name the political faction, as the Federalists would call them from our founding era. Mm-hmm. You would have these factions and you would vote for them. But what you're voting for is you're not voting for an absence thereof. You are an accessory to the continuation of the state as it is when you cast your vote. I think being involved in politics is an immoral act. One of the brilliant things that Stefan Molyneux has done for the libertarian movement, especially among the ANCAPs, and I'd like to refer to myself as an abolitionist more often than an anarchist, because the latter term is so filled with political baggage. And I know at badquaker.com, of course, that the Quakers themselves historically were among probably the earliest organized abolitionist sentiment in this country, in America.
Right.
And what happens with the Socratic rulings, I'll say, so why is voting wrong? Well, voting is immoral. Well, why is it immoral? It is immoral because essentially it's a serial killer beauty contest in which you are saying, this guy murdered 14 people instead of 17, so I'm going to cast my vote. And then you say, well, why is that wrong? To which I would respond, because essentially what I'm doing is instead of abstaining or standing up and saying, I will not get my hands dipped in that kind of bloodlust, I'm stepping away from it. I'm not going to participate in that. And then you say, well, how will you have any impact on the society around you? And you can say you can do that through means that are other than political, because political is a very narrow focus of the human condition. But so many people think that because they can't pay attention to Edward Abbey's admonition that grown men and adults don't need leaders, they insist that they have somebody to lead them around by the nose. And so Socratic drilling is an example where you can take anything. It could be global warming. It could be NASA. It could be any of your pet peeves. It could be religious, political, whatever the case may be. And you continue to ask yourself why, because what you discover, what Socrates taught us, was that in a lot of ways, the question can be much more substantive than the answer, because it tells you that you're heading in the correct direction of inquiry. It's much like reading. I'm sitting in my library right now, Ben, and I have a library annex on my house, which is also why the sound quality is so good on this podcast from my end. I read a lot, but what I also discover is that reading doesn't really take place until I take my eyes off the page. The reason for that is because in the physical act of reading, in which my cognition is reading those words and processing them in my head, I'm processing them, but I'm not necessarily reading them. What's going to happen is that I'm going to set the book down. I usually have pen and paper handy to take notes. And then I'm going to lean back, probably grab the bridge of my nose, close my eyes, relax, and think about what I just read. Because I can read all day long. I can read 500 pages, 200 pages, whatever it is. But if I don't try to think and process and cogitate on what is in my head, then mm-hmm. I won't be able to really advance myself philosophically or epistemologically. Epistemologically is a philosophical term for the acquisition and manipulation of knowledge. Mm-hmm. There's a fellow by the name of Mortimer Adler who wrote a book called How to Read a Book. And again, I know that sounds trite, and it's a rather thick tome, and I recommend to your audience that they get a hold of this as soon as possible and read it. He talks about four levels of reading. Now, the most basic level is where one is simply taking in the words, but you're not looking at it very reflectively or critically. The most advanced level is where, Ben, what would one of your historical reading habits be? Is there a historical slice that you find that you're always attracted to in your own reading?
Yeah, a couple, actually. I am fascinated with right around the history to prehistory time zone, around the blend of the late Stone Age and early Bronze Age. And then I'm also fascinated with the time frame right around the Declaration of Independence and that whole time frame in there.
Okay, let's take the Declaration of Independence and such in 1775 and that entire era. And let's suppose that it's either the drafting of the DI, which I don't think was written by Thomas Jefferson, but I think was written by Thomas Paine, and the events that led to our eventual divorce with the UK in the 8-year war until 1783. And let's say it's either Lexington and Concord or the drafting of the DI or the Federalists versus the Anti-Federalists. What you'll do is if you read three or four or five or more books on the same subject by different authors with different points of view, you start to interrogate those books in a fashion where you may not be a degreed or credentialed academic, but if you're paying attention, you start to look at things, you start to see inconsistencies, you start to see consistencies. You compare, you contrast, and you can even find where, well, that evidence isn't quite what this author makes it out to be, because I read these three other books and they may not have intuitively and consciously told me through my interrogation of those books what these facts are that are starting to come together. For instance, what I just mentioned about Thomas Jefferson not having drafted the DI and having lifted that from Thomas Paine, which I suspect is a possibility. One can arrive at those conclusions not because you find a paper in the American Historical Association that says Thomas Paine was the author. It wasn't Thomas Jefferson. It's because you are intuiting in some fashion that that's the case, even though it's not staring at you off the page. Let me give you a quick example. There's a fellow out there whose job I would love to have called Malcolm Gladwell. He's a guy who he's written The Tipping Point and several other books. And what he basically writes about is various intellectual questions that he finds interesting, and he digs into them. In this one case, they find a kouros, which is a Greek masculine statue. And apparently it comes on the market. It's very rare to find one as good as this one is in its condition and such. And it comes on the market, and it can fetch a very high price. So they call in some art historians and such, and they say, so what do you think? Is this authentic? Now, five of these art historians are looking at this, and they're saying, you know what? The metallurgical studies, the curvatures, everything seems to fit. The scale seems to fit. But there's something that's bugging us about this, and we can't put our finger on it. Well, it turns out to be a fake. Why is it a fake? It's because of the knowledge that they had in their narrow slice of inquiry over years of time had given them an almost unconscious appreciation of how the facts, the theoretical constructs, the hypotheses should lay themselves out. Everybody in your audience, and you included, Ben, you guys have an area of expertise in which you have been doing it for so long, and Gladwell says, in order to get perfection in something, you have to have 10,000 hours or 10 years to actually get that. For instance, he talks about why were the Beatles so successful? It's because for 7 days a week, 80 hours a week, for almost 2 years in Europe in the early 60s, they played together and they played everything. So over time, they got to riffing with each other to such an extent that their improvisational sense became almost supernatural between them. And you've got that. So I guess I'm going around the I'm taking a long road here to tell people that if you have an area of inquiry that you're looking into and you're trying to improve your critical thinking skills and such, not only do you have to master both formal and informal logic, not only do you have to be familiar with fallacies, not only should you practice Socratic drilling, not only should you practice Adler's admonitions about the four levels of reading and that highest level of reading in which you're comparing disparate inquiries into the same subject matter, but you have to have, over time, this unconscious interrogation of what's going on around you, which helps you to build a more sophisticated worldview. A sophisticated worldview, and not that you know the finest wines or anything like that, but a sophisticated worldview that lets you discern the BS from what reality is.
Yeah, and that's critical too, because you know, I try to avoid television whenever possible, but we can't, you know, in this society we're stuck with it. And there are times when you need the ability to just look at what's being fed to you and recognize this is propaganda, this is brainwashing, and I'm not going to take it.
You know, we haven't watched television going on 18 years now. We do have streaming, but we haven't had a broadcast or satellite in our home. We made a conscious effort to do that when we started homeschooling our children, and we haven't looked back. I would submit to you that among the other things that has turned our entire society in America, if not large swaths of humanity across the globe, is what Harlan Ellison called the golden teat. I mean, the glass teat, the television and such. It's so harmful on so many levels. But then again, do we watch it? Sure, we watch it. For instance, We've been watching Hell on Wheels lately, my wife and I, because sometimes we'll do projects in the evening and we'll watch that. So I got that on Netflix streaming. Is it ahistorical? Yes. Is it interesting? It does have its moments. So there is genuinely good television out there, but if you have cable or satellite, there's this sense among a lot of people, and women would say among a lot of men, that put us in front of a television with a remote, and we will just randomly select and start pressing buttons, and our ability to apprehend the world, I think, starts to go over the cliff. Our ability to pay attention to things starts to diminish. And what's most important, I know we're all over the map here, Ben, and I appreciate you indulging me. You're familiar with PowerPoint?
Uh-huh.
Well, the government, for those in your audience who aren't aware, the government and unfortunately corporations live and breathe by PowerPoint.
Absolutely.
PowerPoint is such that to explain to those who may be from Mars in your audience, PowerPoint is a Microsoft program that allows you to put slides together in which words, pictures, graphics, things are on it. And this is where you'll have people droning on in a lecture style with an audience in front of them about a business project or a class that you've taken, something like that. I think that PowerPoint has caused us to have significant cognitive failures, because you'll find in the government that if you can't put it on PowerPoint, the government assumes it cannot exist. But there are narrative chains of argument and narratives of logic and explanation that demands much more than what you can put on PowerPoint. What the assumption is that if you can't put it on PowerPoint, and a lot of this can't be put on there, is that it doesn't exist, which means that a lot of the explanations that you and I would want to carefully craft to explain to people, for instance, what we were talking about earlier, not voting, a lot of those explanations can't be done in a 10-second soundbite. It can't be done in a conversation that takes 10 minutes. It has to be done over time, where we're each paying attention to each other in a conversation and having this back and forth. And that's where, to me, that's where true philosophical investigation, examination, and enlightenment occurs. It is where Ben and I are sitting, sipping tea or maybe the Irish or Scotch holy water on the porch, and we're talking about all of these things, because conversation's dying. I mean, I think that's why I'm attracted to 18th and 19th century literature and primary sources. When I read The Gentlemanly Cadence, especially in Southern novels or in Southern history, and I read the language that was employed and the elegance and such, I'm very attracted to that. And it was a way of transmitting ideas that is significantly more elegant than what we have today.
We're breaking here just for a moment while I tell you about something that you're going to find over at badquaker.com on the right-hand side of the website. If you scroll down there, what you're going to find is a button, actually it's a banner, that will take you to Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom. Now, you're listening to me and you're listening to Bill talking about history and talking about things that are maybe not accessible to or maybe not taught on in the normal classrooms or even in college classrooms. But if you go over there to badquaker.com and you scroll down the right-hand side and you'll see that banner for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, what you're going to find there is you're going to find a class that you can take, and there's a variety of ways you can do this. There are MP3s that you can, once you get enrolled, you can get the MP3s, there's printable material, there are audio and video files that are available, and the banner on badquaker.com may give you an impression that it's a little bit of a Ron Paul minarchist type thing, but trust me, at Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, you're going to find a variety of instructors, and you're going to find really good, solid stuff on history and economics, and you can sort of tailor it to the way that you want. But seriously, get over there to badquaker.com, click on that banner for Tom Wood's Liberty Classroom, and take a look for yourself. It's really about the best way I know right now to be able to get a grasp on the things that Bill and I are talking about history. Thanks very much. I'll get right back to the interview with Bill Buppert. Thank you. Now, we were just talking about PowerPoint, and I wanted to throw this thought in there. When I was in the aerospace industry, I discovered exactly what you're talking about with PowerPoint. It didn't matter how good or how bad the idea was. It didn't matter how much money that you could save the company or how much money it was going to cost the company. None of those things mattered. The only thing that mattered really was that you could put together a really good PowerPoint presentation. And if you could put together a PowerPoint presentation that was good enough, the bosses over you would accept it. It didn't matter what kind of a ridiculous premise it was. Now, the little team that I was working on and the last thing that I was working on before I left the industry, we were looking at saving the company about $800,000 up front. They were looking at laying off 18 employees and between 18 and 20 employees. And we, in addition to the monetary the upfront monetary savings of $800,000, we were going to save the jobs of those 18 to 20 employees, keep them fully employed, and in addition to that, save them, if I recall, it was something like, no, maybe I got the numbers backwards. Maybe it was $400,000 the first year that we were going to save them and $800,000 each additional year. I think that's more like what the numbers were. But that was a long time ago, so I could be wrong. But anyway, but you see my point either way. Now, this was a wonderful plan. It was upgrading an old system that was really old. But in order to present this and get it accepted, and keeping in mind that the company I was working with is basically a shadow of the government anyway, we had to put it in almost cartoonish kindergarten form to present it to our bosses because they just couldn't grasp it any other way. And that's what the PowerPoint tool was for us. It was a way to make things cartoonish enough to so that the decision makers could actually accept it.
Oh, I agree completely, Ben. I mean, that's the thing that that I've encountered in my past and in the current day job that I have is that as far as efficiency and effectiveness are concerned, it simply isn't a primary concern. There was a something called Future Combat Systems, and this is a drop in the bucket of how the DoD spends its money. The contract was canceled. They had a year left on the contract. They had a burn rate of $10 million a week that they had to fulfill before the contract expired. Nearly a third of $1 billion had to be spent, even though nothing would happen with that money because of the way contracting works in the U.S.
Wow.
And it's, but, you know, that's just a it's a microcosm of what happens on a huge scale in the U.S. federal government. You know, economically, we're done. It's just a matter of when, not if, there's a collapse. But there is no one within the government I'm aware of at senior official levels who's actually acknowledging that this party's actually going to be over because they all say, well, we'll find some kind of solution set. But there is none.
Right. I want to take us in a slightly different direction. I know that your knowledge of history is pretty good, to say the very least. And I wanted to contrast two individuals. I wanted to allow you to contrast two individuals, and that's George Washington and Ethan Allen. A couple times I've taken shots at George Washington because he's not one of my favorite people who's ever existed. And I think he gets a very unfair whitewashing of his life and activities. But there are a lot of parallels between Washington and Ethan Allen. They were both land speculators, a different style, but they were both land speculators. They were both military minded, and they're both remembered for their military adventures. But why don't you tell me your opinion of the two gentlemen?
Well, sure. I think that Ethan Allen was a tremendous military mind for his time. George Washington, he's one of those accidental great captains of history who's been given a whole lot of credit for things that aren't necessarily because of his own native brilliance or his ability as a military man. If you look before the Revolutionary War, his was a huge list of military failure for the most part. The only reason Washington is regarded in the fashion that he is because the English, were not fighting simply the colonials from 1775 to 1783. the French were fighting a modern world war. This world war, of course, had been inaugurated in the French and Indian Wars through the late 1750s and the 1760s, which had prostrated both nations, the French more so economically, before the beginnings of the American Revolution. This American Revolution was part of a military conflagration that was consuming England around the planet. It wasn't simply here. And we'll have to remember that there's a number of folks out there, I remember, during 9/11 who were saying, well, the French are bad, the French are this. If it weren't for the French, we would not have a nation as America. In 1783, it was French arms, the French navy, French training, French uniforms, French weapons, French military ability, having been one of the most formidable land powers on Earth for the last 200 years up to that point, 100 years up to that point. If it weren't for the French, we wouldn't have succeeded. Ethan Allen, on the other hand, was, as you mentioned, he was with the Green Mountain Boys, and he knew that the rifle, which was an essential component that did help to give us an edge over the British lobsterbacks, their regular army, in the fighting that they had during that eight-year fight with them. Very impressive. But Ethan Allen never assumed a level of generalship or statesmanship that Washington did, because Washington was a politician first and foremost. Ethan Allen was a land speculator, a farmer, a tireless businessman, a philosopher, a writer, a number of things. He was a Renaissance man. But then again, there was also Benedict Arnold, who we use that term as a conflation with Quisling. Yet I would submit to you, Benedict Arnold was the most talented soldier that we had on the American side during the conflict with the British to try to get our divorce and establish an Atlantic American nation.
Right.
Washington is just, he leaves a bad taste in my mouth, period. He was aristocratic, and they talk about his humility. There was really no humility in the man. That doesn't mean he didn't have redeeming qualities. For instance, in homeschooling our children, Washington had this small little book called Rules of Civility and Rules for Gentlemen. And I liked it a lot, and we used it in homeschooling. So I'm not saying that Washington was, as a whole cloth, a bad man, but Washington was, first and foremost, a politician, and second, a military man. And I'm saying military man, not military genius, because I don't think there was a lot of military genius going on there. Now, why is Washington held in such high esteem? Because he was on the side of the Federalists. Why are the Federalists held in such high esteem? Because the Federalists were the ones who won against the Anti-Federalists, and it was the Federalists who gave us this Constitution, and it's the Constitution that gave us this Leviathan state that has become the largest and most powerful government on the face of the planet, far outstripping the USSR in its ability both to wage war on the planet and to wage war on its own people.
And you said something critical there, too, that Ethan Allen embraced the rifle. And the opposite side of that is that George Washington never grasped the importance of the rifle. He was stuck with muskets. That's what he outfitted his men with. And he literally hated the Appalachian volunteers that came in with their rifles, because it was their intent to shoot officers. And he thought that was disgusting.
Wow. Ben, you have really what a great point you've made that I've never quite put my finger on, because I've always tried to figure out, well, what is it about? There are things about Washington that bothers me militarily when I examine the history, but you are correct, because members of your audience who saw The Patriot, you see that silly notion where we're 60 to 75 meters apart, the Continentals and the British regulars stand, and then they fire at each other in these formations.
It's crazy.
Yeah, part of that's a legacy of the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia and the generations of warfare, of which there are four, but we can discuss that some other time. Washington liked that. That's how Washington was reared. That's what he appreciated, because he had been a British officer, of course. You know, when Paul Revere was riding, Paul Revere didn't say the British are coming on April 19th, 1775. He said the regulars are out, because Paul Revere at the time was British in the saddle. And for the most part, I would submit to you that Washington never lost his essential Britishness, his essential notion that the state must be powerful, monarchies must be respected, in that in the end, we have to put a gun in the hands of the national state so that they can take care of the rabble and riffraff that comprise most of the non-aristocratic culture in America at the time, even after 1783.
Now, this kind of leads us to the next logical question that I had for you. I was going to read the dictionary definition of a coup d'etat, but I think you kind of corrected me on that when we were talking on the phone last night, that what happened when the Constitution was adopted was not necessarily a coup d'etat. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that after our conversation. I think the distinction between both French words, of course, coup de main is a blow with the hand, and a coup d'etat is a strike against the state, or a coup, a push, or an overthrow.
Mm-hmm.
It's Lutwak, if Edward Lutwak, who wrote a book on coups, could tell us and parse out between these two. I think for the purposes of our discussion about the Constitution, if we were to refer to it as either a coup d'etat or a coup de main, both could be forced to fit it. But on reflection, a coup d'etat is more appropriate, because a coup d'etat, it does read as a strike against the state or a strike blow of the state. And what happened when they met in 1786 and 1787 to form the Constitution, their charter was to take the Articles of Confederation, which had been ratified since 1781, and improve them. They had taken 6 years to get that ratification. But what Washington and the Federalist and Madison and his evil little minion Hamilton did is they said, you know what we need to do is we need to dispense with the Articles of Confederation. And the main reason we need to dispense with the Articles of Confederation, if you examine it, and I wrote an article on why the Constitution is a god that failed that people can find on Lou Rockwell, in which I authored a little chart on there that compares the powers of the article versus the powers of the Constitution. What Washington et al. Did not like about the Articles is that they gave a central government essentially no power whatsoever. And as I mentioned earlier, and I stole this from Boston Tea Party in his brilliant book, Hologram of Liberty, Washington and Hamilton needed to put a gun in the hands of the national state to have the ability to tax and regulate beyond state borders down to the atomistic and individual level in order to retain and expand the power that they needed to have the government they envisioned. I know that sounds like a mouthful, but essentially what the Constitution did is it aggregated, amalgamated, and appropriated all the power in the subsidiary political entities, here the states or provinces, and it put them in the hands of the federal government and gave the federal government essentially an unlimited state. What you find with ratification in 1791 of the Constitution, and I think the Constitution is probably one of the most brilliant engines for big government that has ever been devised by mankind, East or West, in five millennia. What it did was it gave the federal government the ability not only to exercise unlimited taxation, not only to make war on its own people, not only to make war on the world, but essentially to put this into play and make it appear to those who Mencken would call the bourgeoisie, make it appear to the American population that they are free, and it is because of the Constitution that they are free. But if we examine it, especially if we look back now, and it's really easy to look back over 225 years and say, good God, how could this have happened to us? How could we have surrendered so much freedom and liberty? You know, you hear people say, well, if we could only get back to the Constitution delivered to us what we have today. The Constitution is a maximum government, unlimited state organism. That's what it was designed as. You know, you mentioned that you like the era of the Declaration of Independence. If members of your audience would take the time to read the 85 anti-federalist articles that are out there and the various writers, to include Brutus and such, who wrote under both nom de plumes and under their real names, their fear was that we had fought this bloody war for 8 years, 13 states go to Paris, and they have a treaty with the UK, not the United States, 13 states. And they have a treaty in 1783 in which they say, our divorce is formal, we're out of here, and we're going to form our own nation states. Not state, our own nation state. And then 4 years later, we have the Federalists coming and saying, you know what, maybe we need to go back to what we just broke away from. Maybe not a precise British analog, because ours would be absent a monarchy, but one in which we can embrace a lot of things that make Great Britain a great power. And of course, what makes Great Britain a great power is the size of their state and the liberties and freedoms that are surrendered by the people there.
I regularly have people say, well, but the Federalist Papers say in this that, and you know, that the government should be limited like this, and to me, it's almost like one of those forehead slapping moments, because I feel like using the Federalist Papers to defend what the Constitution is supposed to do is kind of like saying about your brand new car that you just bought, well, I had to buy the four-way power mud flaps because the salesman said that it worked best with, you know, with the $900 undercoating and the $300 interior coating. And the Federalist Papers as a defense of the Constitution is like the words of that salesman.
I agree completely. And going back to our earlier conversation about critical thinking, let's establish a counterfactual here. Let's ask ourselves a very simple question. Does the word unconstitutional have any descriptive value contemporarily?
Right.
You know, it has no value. You know, we had D.C. versus Heller, where D.C. had said, you know, we don't want your own pistols, so we're going to infringe on that right. And then 4-5, 4 of the Supremes say, no, there's no individual right. And 5 say, well, there's sort of an individual right. Notice I didn't say there is an individual right, because Scalia, supposedly the most conservative, and Thomas is the only liberty-minded jurist among the Supremes. All the rest are unanointed collectivists. Scalia talks about dangerous and unusual.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, well, there are some weapons that we should be able to regulate. No, there's not. No, there isn't.
Was the Constitution
written that way? It was written that way purposefully.
Exactly. Yes, that's my point.
Yeah.
And I say this pretty frequently, and I've upset people at times, but the Constitution is written in such a way that you can literally take it any way that you want to. Those people on the far left believe that they're being constitutional.
Amen. I think, you know, it's an ambiguous document, and if it was the document that the – if I can take a quick segue here. I'm not going to employ the term left and right, because I think, like unconstitutional, has no descriptive value whatsoever. I use the term collectivist, individualist, and then a preamble of interventionist and non-interventionist. I am a non-interventionist individualist. I can't think of a clearer way to distinguish where I am philosophically. If I tell you I'm a man of the right, then you'll say, well, there's a claim that Hitler and Mussolini were men of the right. Or if I say I'm a man of the left, well, there's a claim that that not only was FDR a man of the left, but Stalin was a man of the left. There's no descriptive value to that. So I think that you'll hear me employ the term collectivist and individualist. And in this case, to me, the Constitution is clearly a collectivist document. What you have, for instance, after ratification in 1791, is that a mere 3 years later, you have George Washington in front of a federal army marching on tax resisters. 7 years later, you have the government coming out and saying, with the Alien Seditions Act, if you criticize the government in print or by word, we will find you. We will find some way to rob you of your liberty. And then, of course, we have 1803, Marbury versus Madison, where the Supremes say, well, we're going to give ourselves the ability to read the tea leaves and conduct a Roman-style augury by dissecting and looking at the intestines here and telling you just what your liberties are and your liberties aren't. Tom Woods, I would urge everybody to read everything they can by Tom Woods. I think he's probably one of the most eloquent expositors of liberty today. He did a study, and I'm paraphrasing here, where he said between 1935 and 1997 or 2000, the Supremes did absolutely nothing to reduce the power of the state, and in fact, rubber stamped the state's ability to do everything that it did, to include, for instance, 1943, Wickard versus Allison. And you're probably familiar with this case. It's very important today because the Commerce Clause was used in this latest healthcare case. In Wickard, what they said was, A man grows wheat on his farm, consumes wheat on his farm, but still affects interstate commerce because the absence of that wheat on this farm being sent elsewhere to sell to people affects commerce.
Yeah.
Because now what we have with the use of the Commerce Clause, if you read the latest did you read the decisions that were made by the Supremes? It's about 200 pages long on the latest healthcare thing.
I didn't. I just with, the overview. Roberts. Yeah, I just got the overview.
I would urge you to read the last 10 pages, especially those audience members if they're interested. Read Thomas's dissension to a dissension. Thomas makes a very important point here. He says what's so radical about this, and I'm paraphrasing, he says what's so radical about this healthcare initiative, which has essentially become a tax, which means it will be unlimited in its application to all the subjects and cattle within the American tax jurisdiction. He says what's so important about this is that not only is it taxing activity, it's taxing inactivity. So again, wow. Like with Whip 43, I'm not an attorney, and I'm simply a spectator when it comes to law and legal stuff. With Wickard versus Allison, what they were saying is that your consumption of wheat on your own property where you're not even selling it still comprises interstate commerce. And then we fast forward to today where he's saying not only are we taxing activity, we are taxing inactivity. Again, I make the case the Constitution is an engine for the unlimited state.
Yep, I believe so. And if you even separate it out and talk about the Bill of Rights, really, you know, people will say, well, that's why the Bill of Rights was added, because that's what balances it out. But not really. The Bill of Rights was really just damage control. That's the part that we're talking about that is so vague it can be taken in any way.
I agree completely. You know, originally the Bill of Rights comprised 200. Then it was reduced to 12, then 11, then 10 finally. And here's what's interesting about the Bill of Rights, and I don't think they're very strong, is that if Ben or Bill get in trouble with the law in some fashion and we get entangled in the legal system, I won't call it a justice system because it doesn't do justice to justice, but we get embroiled in the legal system, what you'll discover is in that 95% of the cases in which the defense attorneys are trying to defend or repair the abridgment of a right, freedom, or liberty, they refer to the Bill of Rights. The reason they do that is because there is nothing in the body of the Constitution itself that would stop the government from depriving you of your liberties and freedom. Mm. And then again, we're doing more Socratic drilling here. You have to ask yourself, the Federalist Papers, if you read them, Hamilton et al. Were saying, no, we don't need a Bill of Rights. That's not important. It's all implicit in the body of the Constitution itself that the government will limit itself. BS. No, it's not, because it was designed from the start to be an engine for big government. From the start. Yeah. There's no going back to an original constitution or going back to the originalist thought or, you know, original interpretation of the document. The original interpretation of the document is that it gives power to the government to do as it wishes.
We have about 5 minutes left in this segment, and I'd like to give you as many future segments as you want, both, you know, right now and any time in the future. But before we get out of this segment of the interview, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your book. Before I even do that, I want to say it's only $3.99. You can't not buy this. I mean, it's less than a hamburger. So there's links. There's going to be links at badquaker.com to get the book. There's going to be links to Bill's website, and you can get the book over there. But one way or the other, $3.99, you can download it to your Kindle or whatever. And, you know, just you got to get this. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, you're very Bill, kind. My website is zerogov.com. I maintain a blog. I also have a forum attached to my blog on which we do a lot of Socratic drilling on that forum. And I would love to have friends, neighbors, community members, audience members come on board the forum. And by the way, I want you to come on the forum. And if you disagree with us, please, I insist that you disagree if you do. And spread your discontent, because cross-examination is the engine of truth. And as I mentioned to Ben, sacred cows make the best burgers. And what we're trying to do is really press the envelope on my ZeroGov forum as far as what does this stateless society that I envision look like, this society that is absent government and rulers. Not absent rules, because rules will always be with us, but absent the kind of arbitrary and vicious law-giving and law-making that government has given us for 5,000 years. My book is Zero Gov, Limited Government, Unicorns, and Other Mythological Creatures. It's a compilation of my essays, along with a nice foreword that former congressional aspirant Brian Miller did for me, and there's an introduction in it. And I'm also working on a novel as we speak that will hopefully be released next March. It goes to the editor in February. And thanks for letting me flog that. I'd love to have people buy my book, but of course I'd love to have people read my blog and go to my forum and just participate, because in the end, what I suspect both Ben and I want to do is make sure that the world that our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren inherit has much less government than we suffer under today.
Yeah, and let me just say something about ZeroGov, your website. First off, there's a really great article over there today, and you should, if you're listening to this on Monday, oh, I'm sorry, this is Tuesday. If you're listening to this on Tuesday, you should get over there, follow the links from badquaker.com if you want to, or just type in zerogov.com and read the article that's on there today. But also, read the one that was on there from July 30th, which is written by your daughter.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's an excellent article.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. She's a homeschooler. She's currently she's just turned 17, and she's currently taking two college classes, because, you know, homeschoolers are more advanced than government schoolers. And she came up with that idea, and for those in your audience who haven't looked at it, it's about the death penalty. I'm opposed to the death penalty. I'm also one of those rara avises in the libertarian oeuvre, as it were, that who is pro-life. So I'm both pro-life and anti-death penalty.
And that's a topic I switched 180 degrees on, like almost overnight. It just dawned on me, why would I agree to let the government have these same people that I've worked around for years and I know their levels of incompetence? Why would I let them have this kind of a decision?
Amen. And you know what? There's a greater philosophical quandary here too. Is that I am not a Christian, but I know that those who are either Christian, Muslim, or Jewish, your root document is the Book of Abraham. And when you look at the Old Testament and then the New Testament, vengeance is keen. Vengeance on the part of the supernatural being who oversees the universe and within this coil. And people say, well, that's a good enough reason to give the government the ability to kill its own citizens. The philosophical quandary for me is that I object to that. I object to that morally, but I also think once you give the government the ability to murder its own citizens, it will never stop.
Right. Let me pause this there. Bill, thanks very much for coming on the podcast with me. Again, the site is zerogov.com, and the book is ZeroGov. Get those links from badquaker.com. Bill, thanks very much for coming on the show with me.
It was an honor, Ben. I've really enjoyed making your acquaintance and getting to know you better.
Thank you very much. Okay, so that was the first half of the interview with Bill Buepert. And tomorrow we're going to post the second half of the interview with Bill, and we're going to literally take right off where we ended on this half of the interview. Now, again, there was a mention in there. Bill mentioned Tom Woods as a great source of history material. So get over to badquaker.com, scroll down the right-hand side there, and check out that banner for Tom Woods. He has this great class that he's made available. And the price is really reasonable. I'm not sure where you're going to find a better source of history and Austrian economics than Tom Woods' class that he's offering there. And again, it is with a variety of different instructors and different ways that you can utilize this resource. Now, be sure and tune in. Yeah, tune in like it's on the radio, right? Well, I guess it is on the radio. Anyway, be sure and get tomorrow's podcast, and we're going to have the rest of this interview with Bill. And hopefully he's going to come back on the show with us in the near future, and we're going to have some more on a different topic. Until then, like I always say, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? There's a lot of places on the internet. But where are you going to go? You're going to go to badquaker.com, aren't you? Thanks, folks. I really appreciate you listening. Goodbye.